Christmas is a beloved holiday filled with traditions. It's celebrated around the world, and it has been for centuries. But were there ever times when it wasn't popular? And have there ever been times when Christmas has actually been canceled?
Welcome to You Totally Made That Up. We are a bi-weekly history podcast that tells you the wildest, craziest, nuttiest stories from yesteryear, ones that sound like somebody must have totally made them up. But they're all true, and we especially like the ones that have supernatural, paranormal, woo-woo elements, so those parts may only be true to the people who lived them. We don't go for the lore says or the legend goes, though. We want dates and names and all the facts that we can find. And I am Nash.
And I am Tiff.
We are your hosts. And happy holidays to all who celebrate such this time of year. And since this one is coming out on Christmas Eve, that's the framework of our topic today. But even if you don't celebrate Christmas, we still think you're going to get a kick out of this.
Yeah, it's got a little bit of everything.
Exactly. There's some upheaval, there's drama, there's heartwarming, it's the whole shebang. Since this is the season of giving, though, can we make a tiny request of y'all? Would you give us a gift? It's no cost. Don't worry. It'll just take a smidge of your time. Would you consider leaving us a review or giving us a 5-star rating or, you know, whatever's the highest on your platform of choice? We don't mention this a lot because we don't like to nag or guilt trip or whatever, but it really does help us grow. And hey, look, even just share us with your followers on social media. If you don't want to go the review route, that's great too. We just really appreciate it. We want as many people as possible to join our little nutty family. And if you've already done so, and several of y'all have, thank you so very much. We really appreciate you guys taking the time to recommend us.
We do. It means a lot.
All right, so enough of that. Talking about our episode topic, we actively try not to focus on the typical stuff. Oh, and on that note, a little plug. Last Christmas, we talked gremlins, so be sure to check that one out. It's called Pigeon Jockeys, and we had a blast with it. This time, the theme is about no Christmas at all. What on earth does that mean, you ask? Well, we need to talk. Come over here. I'm patting the imaginary sofa beside me. Come on, sit by Auntie Nash and Auntie Tiff.
It's cozy. You'll be okay.
It's going to be okay. Bring a cocktail. It's fine. And just listen to us, because we have to try and make some of y'all understand something. Or maybe none of y'all. Maybe our darling listeners already get this. But just in case. It has cracked us up over the years, because this has been going on for years, at least in the U.S. Let us know if this happens in your neck of the woods. But hearing talk about, they want to cancel Christmas, ! Accidental number one, ! It's the infamous they. So, just to clear that up, nobody wants to cancel Christmas. It's not possible to cancel Christmas. To quote Jurassic Park, Christmas will find a way. I mean, I'm not. That's
that
not the quote.
That could have made that movie even better. I don't know.
If it was said at Christmas time. Yeah, I mean, that's not the quote. It's the spirit of the quote. Okay, leave me alone.
Now I just want to see Christmas raptors.
Christmas raptors in their cute little elf shoes.
Could you imagine them pulling a sleigh?
Little jingle bells around their necks. They're a little bitey, but you know. And this year, with specific regards to the pandemic, hey, Christmas still isn't canceled. You just need to not be a dumbass and go partying and have everybody and their mother over at your house. But turns out, there have been some times where Christmas was almost canceled, or at least elements of it. Times when the typical holiday stuff you think of as commonplace weren't exactly welcome, let's say. And Tiff, I tell you, one aspect of this that really wears me out is the whole, we're going to say Merry Christmas and not Happy Holidays, because fuck you. I just, listen, that's fine. That's fine. You say what you want to say. There's other holidays going on around this time of year, but say Merry Christmas. It's how freedom works. In lots of places around the world, you can say most anything you want to. That's under your control. But what's not under your control? You need to be prepared for people's responses. You need to be prepared for a reply that potentially leaves you feeling embarrassed. Freedom to speak, yes, but not freedom from consequences of that speech. Oh, and also, to be clear, in the event that you think I'm picking on some subgroup of the population or another, and there are certain subgroups who make up the majority of people who think that some great evil force is trying to cancel Christmas by saying, hey, maybe you just be kind to all by thinking to say, Happy Holidays. But in case you think that I'm picking on just them, I have the same amount of ire for the people who tend to fall into other certain subgroups that willfully misinterpret the song, Baby, It's Cold Outside.
Ugh, y'all. I almost went y'all on that.
You almost let out a y'all.
I almost let out a y'all.
Miss Wisconsin, I'm see that it's infuriating. Stop reading into that shit. It's about a gal who wanted to hook up with this guy, but it was the freaking 1940s, and she was worried about what the neighbors would think and was looking for excuses to stay, and he was playing along. I hate it so much. It flames on the sides of my face, breathing, heaving breaths. It drives me up the wall.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. See, this is why we're friends.
This is exactly why we're friends. And you know, I remember reading, and if I can find it, I'll put it in supplemental stuff and show notes. But I recall reading that the songwriter's daughter was like, my dad wrote that for him and my mom to sing at parties. Like, ugh, you think it's about? No, it's no. I didn't expect to get fired up this early. I hope we haven't lost a bunch of people. Or, you know, see you later. I don't know. Anyway, for this one, a little bit of a different format. We've done this before when we've talked about fairy tales. But instead of going one at a time, we're going to go back and forth because this is a collection more than singleton streamlined stories, and they all kind of hook up together going down through time. So to begin, let's give you a little setup on the background of Christmas. And we're not going to go fully down this road. You can likely find this on other podcasts, or you've learned this at some point during your life. So this is just more of a refresher. And of course, different parts of the world celebrate Christmas different ways. We're not going to go on that journey either. We did a little bit in some spooky snacks from last year, a handful of deities or folk tales that caught our eye, so you can go back and check those out. We're going to focus on Europe, mostly England and America for this one. Your scoop on times when Christmas, or parts of it rather, were actually canceled in those places. Or at least the effort was made.
Oh, they tried.
Yeah, spoiler. But they tried hard. Way back when, in ancient times, there was a wintry festival called Saturnalia that was full of drunken revelry celebrating the Roman god of agriculture. Quote, instead of working, Romans spent Saturnalia gambling, singing, playing music, feasting, socializing, and giving each other gifts. Now that sounds sweet. What else? Quote, it was a wild party involving gambling, singing, and even cross-dressing. Well, that sounds even sweeter. And as the years went by, while the angle regarding the praising of the god Saturn faded, the celebrations continued. When Christianity started getting going in Europe, and we're talking medieval times in the 5th-ish century ballpark, the Christian leaders began transforming it into meaning celebrations related to the birth of Jesus. Do we know when Jesus was born for sure? No, we do not. But scholars are pretty damn sure that it wasn't on December 25th due to various clues given in the story. Again, not going down that road here. You're going to have to trust us. So who cares why they picked that specific calendar day of the season, but they did. The attitude was basically, party on, we can't stop you, but remember the reason for the season is capital G godly, Christian godly, not lowercase g pagan godly in nature. It was still wild though, and that lasted a good many years, as you'll hear. And it got really wild. This actually reminds me of Halloween celebrations. Check out the episode Beaver Knockers and you'll get what I mean. Quote, in England, the drunken mobs would take over the streets, and a beggar would be crowned the Lord of Misrule. The mobs would bang on people's doors and demand to be served with the best food and drink they had. And if they refused, they were threatened with violence. Merry Christmas, motherfuckers. Not happy holidays. Like I say, it goes on like this for a bajillion of years. Things get adjusted or replaced or tweaked. That's just how life goes. And some things were accepted, others not so much. The celebrations waxed and waned. We now go to Tiff, who shall take us forward in time.
Indeed. Let's start with talking about Christmas caroling. Could you imagine Christmas carols as protest songs?
That's amazing.
Oh, yeah. And Christmas carols, you know, they really started off as Roman hymns. That kind of chanting, I'm not going to attempt it because that's embarrassing for me.
I know what you mean, like Gregorian chant-esque type. Yeah.
Right. You know, you go to church and they're all da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, whatever. That's how it started. Those were kind of early carols. Like you mentioned, I mean, there was a lot of feasting, a lot of celebrating. And it wasn't really until the year 1012 that singing during like the feast days became really popular, especially among the masses. And that was because the kings and the other lords and sovereigns were all kind of busy and they were off at church and doing their yearly meetings. And so the peasants and the lower class people were kind of bored and they were left unsupervised. So they're like, fuck it, we're just going to party. So they start singing and dancing to celebrate the holiday season. And then by the reign of Henry II in 1170, they really continued pushing it even more with, like you said, plays and spectacles and dice games, really going back to kind of those good old heathen times. And this all continued, went on and on for centuries. By Henry VII, dice, cards, and other gambling was forbidden throughout the year, except during the 12 days of Christmas. And then by the time we get to Henry VIII, I mean, it's just a big 12-day Mardi Gras party. Like you said, you know, when I was looking through this, I was like, Jesus, it's like Halloween. It really is. Henry VIII even wrote a Christmas carol called Green Groweth the Holly. Now, up to this point, they're all still very religious, very hymnal, not the fun Christmas carols that we think of. Starting in medieval times, wassailing became a common practice, which you kind of touched on a little bit about going door to door and demanding food and drink. But wassailing was a little bit different. It was kind of a way for charity to be given out, but not seen as begging. People would go out with their giant wassail bowls, which some of them were not huge. They're kind of big goblets, I guess you could say. And then some...
What's a wassail bowl?
Yeah. And some of them...
So you weren't saying wassail bowl. You're saying wassail bowl.
Am I?
Are you?
I don't
what
know.
Are you trying to say? Are these two separate words, wassail and bowl?
Yeah.
Oh.
I've already had too much wassail.
You're so wassable. Like it was.
It's like it's washable.
Like it, or like it was a child's toy. Like, watch, mom, I can convert this wassable into a chuck.
That's the. Just that Midwestern, let's just combine all the words.
Oh, I'm Southern. Like, I can talk, please. Literally, like, I can talk.
All right. Wassail bowl? Wassail bowl? How do you pronounce it?
Oh, I say wassail, but I was trying to, like, enunciate, like, really hard to try to figure out what you were saying.
I'll slow down. I'll say it again, in case everybody is unclear.
Oh, this isn't being edited. They know. Now they know.
Wassail bowl. Okay. Sometimes they're goblets. Sometimes they're big. They're like 10 gallons and ridiculous. They're filled with drink. And depending on the recipe you follow, I'm not so sure about this. I mean, the basis is just a spiced or like mulled cider ale. There's apples in it. And I'm totally down for that. But then we get to the lamb's wool or the froth wassail. It includes beaten eggs that are added to like make a froth on top when it's heated up. And then once it's all frothy, it gives it the appearance of lamb's wool, hence that name. And then they dip toast or bread to soak up the froth. And
because it's runny scrambled eggs.
I am just not okay with this at all. It sounds so gross. It's nasty. But people would go around, like I said, they've got their wassables. They sing. What they basically do is they offer goodwill and good wishes to the lord of the manor, the house. And in return, the lord would give them food and drink and everybody's happy. It's a good thing. It's not begging because they're actually offering each other good wishes and cheer. Still not convinced on the egg wassail. A quote that I came across that refers to more recent times, but I think applies to this, is that Christmas Carol brings people together. It's one of the few times in the year that people stop what they're doing, spend time with one another, and sing together to celebrate. Communal singing of well-known carols offers an immediate connection across cultures and languages, putting aside any political backgrounds and bringing together a group of people for sheer enjoyment. So that was really what was going on, because during these feasts and celebrations in the 12 days of Christmas, everybody was allowed to let loose. It didn't matter your station. You were given that time to enjoy and have fun. And it's all good times. Everybody's on board with this until the English Civil War and the switch of power from the monarchy to the parliament. With all that partying that was going down, Christmas was considered a public holiday. Businesses were closed, church services were attended. If a shop did open during that time, it was really limited hours. There were social norms in place to allow people to have that time off to enjoy it and to feast and to celebrate. But this was just not going to do for those who were trying so hard to reject the Roman Catholic faith. Quote, singing and related Christmas festivities were not only abhorrent, but sinful. They viewed the celebration of Christ's birth on 25th of December as a popish and wasteful tradition that derived with no biblical justification from the Roman Catholic Church, thus threatening their core Christian beliefs. And on the 19th of December, 1643, an ordinance was passed encouraging subjects to treat the midwinter period with the more solemn humiliation because it may call to remembrance our sins and the sins of our forefathers who have turned this feast, pretending the memory of Christ, into an extreme forgetfulness of him by giving liberty to carnal and sensual delights. Ooh, they're in trouble. And then in January 1645, a group of ministers appointed by Parliament produced a new Directory of Public Worship, which set out a new church organization and new forms of worship to be adopted and followed in England and Wales. The directory made it very clear that Sundays were to be strictly observed as holy days for the worship of God, but there were to be no other holy days. Quote, festival days, vulgarly called holy days, having no warrant in the Word of God, are not to be continued. The rejection of Christmas was reiterated in 1647 when an ordinance confirmed the abolition of the feasts of Christmas, Easter, and Whitsun. They did, however, allow servants to have every second Tuesday of the month to partake in reasonable recreation, basically to make up for taking away all of the holy day celebrations throughout the year. So, yay, I suppose. And it's from this point until the Restoration in 1660 that Christmas was officially illegal. And I'm quoting here, no observation shall be had of the 5th and 20th day of December, commonly called Christmas Day, nor any solemnity used or exercised in churches that day in respect thereof. Those who did end up braving it and going to Nativity Mass were actually taken in by soldiers who guarded the churches. And the usual festivities during the 12 days of Christmas that ran from December 25th to January 5th were deemed unacceptable. People did what they needed to do to protest this. In Scotland, in particular, authorities cracked down on carol singing. Anyone who invited holiday singers into their homes could be fined £5. And then in Aberdeen, more than a dozen women were arrested one Christmas for the crime of singing of filthy carols on Yule Day. I say good for them. One minister denounced the singing of carols as on par with the sin of fornicating. And then caroling was really used as a form of protest. Some people would sing all night, keeping up members of parliament and mayors and other government officials. Sometimes they would get arrested. Sometimes they were paying fines. Other leaders kind of just turned a blind eye to people celebrating despite the ordinances because they didn't agree with it. Some towns had outright riots. Some shopkeepers did not go into work as they were supposed to, and some people still displayed some of their holiday decorations. Even once the Anglican Church restored Christmas in the late 17th century, religious authorities still only allowed a really toned-down observance of Christmas, and carols were still on the list of prohibited activities. So, who is responsible for all the rules and the crackdowns on Christmas? A lot of the blame gets set on Oliver Cromwell, also known as Old Ironsides, and he was the Lord Protector of the Commonwealth, and supported the party that was making all those rules in Parliament, the Puritans, because they don't want anybody to have fun. And it wasn't just in England, Scotland, and Ireland where they were pulling this shit.
That is correct. America was not immune from this either, thanks to some of the original English transplants who were said Puritans, aka the Pilgrims. They were, as you can imagine, on the same page as Cromwell. They were called Puritans because they, you guessed it, wanted to purify, and not just you and me, they wanted to purify Christianity as a whole, part of this being anything they deemed rooted in pagan tradition. Anything stemming from Germanic and Celtic folklore was out. And Tiff kind of got into this a little bit. They, interestingly, did not cotton to the idea that Jesus was born on December 25th, which, as we've covered, that's likely right. One of my sources saying, quote, "Their theological argument was that they saw nothing in Scripture to warrant the celebration of Christ's birth. They saw Christmas as a sly trick played by the early Catholic Church to graft Christianity onto the older pagan ways of Europe." Smart, smart, smart. That's correct.
They were totally right on that.
Like we said, that is precisely what went down. They also saw it as kind of worshiping Jesus, who is distinct from God. So for them, it was almost like worshiping another deity. Basically, the only way Christmas was associated with anything Christian was if it happened to fall on the Sabbath when they were getting their godly on anyhow. And they were blunt about it. They referred to Yuletide as Fooltide. Very witty, and a bit more about Yule later on. And as far as the 12 days of Christmas, which, as Tiff mentioned, is not 12 days leading to, it starts on Christmas and goes forward 12 days. Well, even though it was after Christmas, of course, that's out too, because it was, quote, denounced as the most immoral time of the year, full of rude revelry, idleness, hard drinking, and promiscuity. So, same story as in England. And they went so far as to label any celebrations of the season as heresy, and then they start getting the law involved. Again, been there, done that. And we're talking in New England here, Massachusetts specifically, because that was the American Puritans' main stomping grounds. The Puritans did try to pull this garbage in other areas they settled, such as in New Jersey and Virginia, but they weren't the majority there, so it didn't fly. Quote, "From 1659 to 1681, anyone caught celebrating Christmas in Massachusetts was subject to a fine of 5 shillings. And my source notes that this was severe because it equated to about a week's wages for your typical laborer. And I've got in show notes an image of a Massachusetts Bay public notice, spelled P-U-B-L-I-C-K, love it, from 1659. And I'm going to invite text-to-speech guy in and have him read this in his British accent. Unless I can find a text-to-speech with a Boston accent, because that would be precious. Anyway, here's what the poster said.
Public notice. For the preventing of disorders arising in places within this jurisdiction, by reason of some still observing such festivals, as were surreptitiously kept in other communities, to the great dishonor of God, and offense of others. It is therefore ordered by this court, and the authority thereof, that whosoever shall be found observing any such day as Christmas or the like, either by forbearing labor, feasting, or any other way, upon any such account as aforesaid, every such person so offending shall pay for every such offense 5 shillings as a fine to the county."
So by my reading, that's not 5 shillings for Christmas as a whole, that's 5 for each thing. So 5 for caroling, 5 for the turkey, 5 per piece of tinsel, 5 per gift. They were even dicks about you giving to others, so no charity either. But seriously, it was extreme. They also banned specific foods associated with the season, such as mince pies and puddings. They required that stores and other businesses remain open. And my favorite, they had town criers walk the streets on Christmas Eve shouting, "No Christmas, no Christmas." And some of y'all were out here getting pissed about Starbucks cups. Yeah, in the U.S. a handful of years back, and I don't know if this happened in other countries, but people here got riled up when the holiday design on freaking Starbucks cups weren't Christmassy enough for them. Like, did they want the mermaid giving birth to the Christ child in a barn? Have a cow shitting in the background? Like, I don't know. I don't know what they wanted. I genuinely don't. In any event, I found an AP article from 2018 that was debunking a Facebook meme going around. And if Facebook is how I remember it, it'll probably still be going around. But it apparently says that Christmas was illegal in the U.S. until 1836, as it was considered an ancient pagan holiday. So now you can tell your mom, when she shares it this year, that no, this was an ordinance in place specifically in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Parents on Facebook love it when you bring facts to the fiction circulating there. Make sure you do it a lot on all manner of topics. Then she and everybody else will say, oh, wow, thank you for correcting us. This is interesting. No, that's not how it's going to go at all. So what happened up in the old bay? Remember, at this time, the U.S. ain't the U.S. yet. The motherland, a.k.a. England, was still technically our ruler. And after King Charles II took the throne, quote, political pressure steadily increased for the colony's Puritan leaders to relax their intolerant laws or risk losing their royal charter. Which, my impression is that this meant more than just the Christmas stick in their asses, because, continuing, in 1681, the Massachusetts Bay Colony reluctantly repealed its most odious laws, including the ban on Christmas. Great, so did the stick fall out? Nope, they kept it pinched. Quote, Christmas was no longer a crime, but it remained completely taboo. Anyone caught making merry or singing carols was prosecuted for disturbing the peace well into the 1700s. So basically, party inside, don't be showing no cheer whilst out and about. Resistance was particularly high the further you got from Puritan strongholds like Boston, out in the fishing towns, about whom Stephen Nissenbaum, author of The Battle for Christmas, writes, were, quote, notorious for irreligion, heavy drinking, and loose sexual activity. And about that prosecution thing, Nissenbaum found no record of people being arrested Gestapo style. This was just about it not being public. Public with a K. Point is, gradually, they got outnumbered. Quote, some social historians suspect that poorer folk and servants who came to New England for work, rather than for faith, may have kept some old customs and traditions alive underground. But what really made the difference in the end was a transformation of the population in this part of the country in the mid-19th century from mass immigration, especially from Ireland. So way to go, Ireland. Between this and Halloween and, you know, building New York City, we have much to thank you for. And speaking of the 1800s, that's where we're headed next, because the stuff we think of nowadays as traditional Christmas staples actually stem from Queen Victoria and were further popularized by Charles Dickens in A Christmas Carol, which Tiff is going to tell us about right now.
Yes, I am. I feel like we're newscasters. Throwing it back to me. Thanks, Nash.
We're going to give a weather report and traffic at the top of the hour. Okay.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people like to say that Dickens invented Christmas, but you're all smart. I mean, you listen to us, so you're super smart. So I don't really need to tell you that that's not true, just like Coca-Cola didn't invent Santa Claus. And I do need to mention before it gets assumed that his story was not at all the first Christmas story that was published. In the early 1800s, there were publications and poems about Santa Claus that had already been out. And there's The Night Before Christmas that was published in 1823 as A Visit from St. Nicholas. A Christmas Carol was published December 19, 1843, and it was an instant success. Dickens was already a popular writer, and this wasn't even his first Christmas story. He published A Christmas Dinner in 1835, in which he talked about a lot of the essentials that we think of for Christmas. Day was about family, there was mistletoe, holly, church, charity, food, turkey, plum pudding, mince pies. Speaking of mince pies, can I tell you about this that I stumbled across?
Absolutely.
I stumbled across this amazing source that will obviously be in our show notes, and I ended up reading through this entire introduction of this book because it gave this extensive history, I mean very detailed history, about some of the Christmas traditions. And one of them included ingredients of a mince pie. And I just need to read this to you guys because it's crazy ridiculous. 2 bushels of flour, 20 pounds of butter, 4 geese, 2 turkeys, 2 rabbits, 4 wild ducks, 2 woodcocks, 6 snipes, 4 partridges, 2 neat's tongues, 2 curlews, 7 blackbirds, 6 pigeons.
And a partridge in a pear tree.
Okay, it was 9 feet in circumference at the bottom and weighed 12 stones.
Hello, me again. Kindly forgive Tiff. She was so excited about this gigantic pie that she neglected to do a little converting for those of you unfamiliar with this measurement of weight. 12 stone is 76.2 kilograms, or 168 pounds. Carry on.
They had to roll it to the table. And it was just basically there to, like, feed the entire community. But I just, seeing mince pie a million times while doing research about what they ate for their traditional meals, I'm just like, oh my God. And then I come across that one, and I just couldn't believe it.
Straight up. Because, you know, I mentioned the Puritans in Massachusetts. Shut that down. Straight up, I agree with them. Because you can't eat all of that in a timely manner. So I don't want a pile of meat sitting out in town square just rotten.
That's got to be like the greasiest pie.
Oh, nasty. How about 20 pounds of butter, did you say?
20 pounds of butter.
Oh, yeah. No.
I mean, I suppose if everybody's kind of digging in, I don't know. I don't know how many people that fed.
Fair enough. I mean, if it was a big town, then yeah. But if they're mostly Puritan, they're not going to be participating, right?
Right.
So you've only got a small chunk of the town. So no, I don't want no damn 9-foot circumference autopsy sitting in the middle of town square. All the wild animals are coming out like da 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 da. Like they're like dinner. Now forget it. Forget it.
Not for you.
Every possum for 10 square miles is going to be coming in and
Oh my goodness. You're going to have everything.
I'm pro-Puritan on this.
Are you looking for a new podcast that talks about, well, everything? If so, you might want to try out my new podcast, Because I Want to Know. The show where I get into people's heads and discuss how the choices in their lives have affected them. We could be talking about anything from true crime, the paranormal, or, I don't know, metal detecting. I'm going to get into the nitty-gritty of what makes people do what they do, a kind of stalking you just can't do on Facebook. So join me each Monday as I sit down and have a chat with some amazing and fascinating guests going through seemingly ordinary lives.
All right, so he talks about the mince pies. And now we've talked about the mince pies, so let's end it there. So just to cover all the bases, in case you don't know, summary of A Christmas Carol is that Ebenezer Scrooge is a miserable, wealthy old bastard who doesn't seem to have a generous bone in his body. He's visited overnight by three ghosts. We've got the ghost of Christmas past, the ghost of Christmas present, and the ghost of Christmas yet to come. He is shown scenes that reflect back to him how awful he is, and he wakes up with a change of heart. Ah, Christmas spirit. So, it was received very well, even with the social commentary on capitalism, because thanks to it, there was a major revival in the recognition and celebration of Christmas at the time. What he was able to do was kind of sift through the old traditions, which people knew about and were still being somewhat celebrated in more rural areas, kind of cherry pick and adjust them for those who worked and lived in the cities and in the industrial areas. People weren't expected to party on for 12 days, to feast on 9-foot pies, to sing and harass your neighbors and gamble. Instead, he kind of gave them a chance to enjoy a nice family feast, surrounded by just a few select people, to be generous and to be charitable. And of course, he was not the only influencer at the time. And I actually just spoke very recently about the influence of Queen Victoria. Her Christmas celebrations were no exception. Thanks to the Industrial Revolution, there was the economic boost. Industry made people wealthy. There were more better paying jobs for the working class. And then again, calling back to other episodes, the working class is now starting to get to the point of enjoying leisure time, enjoying train travel that made it possible to visit family that they probably didn't see very often otherwise. With industrialization comes mass production. So instead of homemade, time-consuming toys or gifts that you had to plan out and make yourself, you could just go out and buy something. The celebrations never quite recovered after those pesky Puritans kind of took out all the good stuff, but they came up with some new and much more familiar traditions that we enjoy today. And it's time for Christmas to become lively again and more fun. We've got mail and Christmas cards. Mail was very costly. It was paid for by the recipient, and it was based on mileage for the delivery. Could you just imagine, like, getting sent a breakup letter and having to pay for it?
I wouldn't take it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't touch it. Like, the mail carrier could just drop it and stand there in the snow for hours. I'm not paying him. No. If I could see on the envelope, be like, who's that from? Oh, it's from your ex. Yeah, no, I'm not. Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Or it's from your boyfriend or whatever. Like, no. No. If he didn't come a-calling himself, no. I know what that is.
Yeah. By 1840, the penny post was established, which made a flat fee that was charged to the sender. And in 1843, Henry Cole commissioned an artist to design a card for Christmas. It was designed as a group of people around a dinner table, and there was a little Christmas message. They printed up 1,000 of these, but they were charging a shilling for each one, which, like you mentioned before, was kind of pricey. So they weren't all that popular, but the idea caught on, and a lot of kids, including Queen Victoria's own children, were encouraged to make their own Christmas cards. So we got to see a lot of people sending them by themselves through the penny post and sending delightful little Christmas wishes. This also became popular because of color printing technology. And as that became more advanced, there was mass production. So the cost went down and a lot of people were able to start sending Christmas cards and it became a tradition. Another thing that I wouldn't say that they added this, but they revived it, was Christmas caroling. These carols were a little bit less religious. They were a little bit more about kind of feasting and togetherness. And carols became popular at this point because they were being printed and they were being distributed among the masses. But it wasn't common, I guess, outside the home and within many homes until people started having pianos in their house and they were able to play accompanying music along with the carols. There's a huge list of carols that basically came around through the Victorian era because there's just this revival of we want to sing to celebrate this season. We've got Silent Night. We've got the English translation of lyrics for O Come All Ye Faithful. We've got O Holy Night. It really is a huge list. I mean, you think of a Christmas carol and it probably came about during the Victorian era. And then back in my first segment, I talked about the elimination of holy and feast days by the church parliament. And this wasn't really something that bounced back all that well, but they were shuffled around and they did kind of find ways to reignite them. St. Nicholas, whose feast day was December 5th, was reimagined as Old Christmas, a thin old man who kind of depicted the holiday season. This evolves. We kind of know how the story goes. Eventually, he becomes the Santa Claus that we know and love today. As far as decorating for the holidays, prior to the Puritan purge, there was decorating, and it would be sprigs. You know, there was holly, ivy, rosemary, bay leaves, a lot of greenery that was abolished. It was frowned upon once the Puritans took over and made everything not fun. But again, this got revived. But putting up some sprigs and some wreaths was just not good enough. And so then that's where we get to one of the most iconic Christmas decorations.
So let's talk Christmas trees. Tiff talked about Queen Victoria, and we have to talk about her husband, Albert. He was German. The Germans also celebrated this time of year, but it was called Yule, which, quote, comes from a name for a 12-day festival celebrated by Germanic peoples around the winter solstice in December and January. Sound familiar? 12 days of Christmas? Uh-huh. And one of the elements of said Yuletide was putting up a decorated tree. Like Tiff said, Queen Victoria kind of helped to get the ball rolling in England regarding reinvigorating Christmas, and the tree specifically had to do with this, as quote, in 1848, the Illustrated London News published a drawing of the royal family celebrating around a decorated Christmas tree. Soon, every home in Britain had a tree bedecked with candles, sweets, fruit, homemade decorations, and small gifts. And that will be in show notes. It's really pretty. I believe if I read correctly, they made it into Christmas postcards as well, that image. But things were still kicking prior to this during the 1800s over in the U.S. in terms of the partying. Quote, the one moment in history that Christmas seemed truly imperiled was the early 19th century when celebrations in the United States had become rowdy, violent affairs. Yuletide wildness, distasteful to the upper classes, was an old phenomenon. But now, gangs of men and boys would roam the streets drinking, vandalizing property, throwing firecrackers, and even invading homes. I mean, it harkens back. Look, they're consistent. And how are our friends in New England specifically faring? Well, quote, Christmas remained taboo in that part of the country until at least 1870, when the federal government declared it a national holiday. So, a point to Christmas. And by the late 1800s, in the U.S., it was getting to be a homey family affair jam, because as more people immigrate, the more these Dickensian Victorian traditions start spreading, including the Germanic-rooted Christmas trees. No pun intended. The deal with the decorating trees is simply this. We don't know. This is one of those I'm going to advise y'all Google, because we're getting into legends and folklore that are without proof. The whole oral history thing, which we don't not value. Here at the podcast, we just prefer sticking to concrete facts where we can. But it does all seem to agree on the German origin, so that I feel confident in saying. To give you a bit, though, one legend has to do with St. Boniface, an 8th century English missionary who, while in Germany, quote, replaced the sacrifices to the Norse god Odin's sacred oak with a fir tree adorned in tribute to the Christ child. And he supposedly saved a kid from getting sacrificed. So good on you, Bonnie. Here's the more concrete stuff. In the Middle Ages, the Christian church would decorate fir trees with apples and called it Adam and Eve Day and would put on plays. Christmas trees are documented as being sold as early as the mid-1500s in Strasbourg, Germany, also accompanied by plays and apples as ornaments. Then Martin Luther came along, and he loved Christmas. He wrote like 5 hymns about it, and he would decorate his tree with lit candles. So fast forward again and come back with me across the pond. Now, throw a rock and you're going to hit a claim about America's first Christmas tree. Here are but a few. As you may have expected, German immigrants kicked things off with the decorating of trees for the holidays, and in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, for one example, it has been documented as early as 1747. In 1835, a German immigrant by the name of Charles Fallon, a professor at Harvard College in Cambridge, Massachusetts, was documented as having a candle-decorated spruce tree. Then in 1836, a fellow German immigrant who was also teaching at Harvard College wrote a Christmas-themed book called A Stranger's Gift, in which was illustrated a decorated tree, and that's actually the first Christmas tree in print in the U.S. We have a town Christmas tree where everybody participated in decorating in Concord, Massachusetts, in 1853, more of the same in New Orleans, Louisiana, in 1855, and in Philadelphia in 1857. You get the idea. The trend is spreading. Backing up a touch, one incident surrounding a supposed first American Christmas tree, at least the first one purportedly staged inside a church, happened in Cleveland, Ohio in 1851, and the only reason I'm telling you about it is so that I can read a fantastic quote. This guy named Heinrich Schwann, has there ever been a more German name? And I'm a quarter German, I can say that, don't at me. He's a reverend, and at his church, there's a forest nearby. He chops down a tree, puts it up in the sanctuary on Christmas Eve. He and his wife decorate it up, and they go wild. They put a silver star on top. This thing has cookies and ribbons and candles, and fancy nuts are mentioned. Not just the regular kind, fancy.
Nice.
Fancy nuts is in contention for the title of the episode. Anyway, lots of the members of his congregation were, like him, German immigrants, and they were just tickled pink coming in to see this on Christmas Day when they're attending service. But over the course of the next few days, it became the talk of the town, and not good talk. He does a ton of research and shares the history and eventually convinces the leaders of the community that Christmas trees were not a bad thing. But at the time, a prominent local newspaper, in what sounds like an editorial, called the Christmas tree, quote, a nonsensical, asinine, moronic absurdity. These Lutherans are worshiping a tree and groveling before a shrub. No one's worshiping the tree. Calm down. Have some spiked eggnog out of a Happy Holidays Starbucks cup. How about that? But thank heavens, nowadays, the candles are gone because all I can see is house fires. And that's because electricity and light bulbs and then teensy little light bulbs on strings. And Thomas Edison is to thank for those last two. Matter of fact, in 1882, an employee of Edison's named Edward Johnson came up with the idea of using light strings on his Christmas tree. And this was the first printed news of such. He also made the tree rotate and the lights go all blinky. I love this dude.
Amazing.
I love it. Anyway, it was expensive, so not a lot of people could do it. But as time passed, it became more affordable, but it's still not super trendy. And then one person in particular helped make it so. Quote, in 1895, President Grover Cleveland decorated the tree at the White House with electric lights. This idea caught on and spread across the country. Why have I told you all this? so that I can tell you about a time in America when the Christmas tree itself, that icon of the holiday, that glorious thing that cats love to attack, that wondrous monument that loves to shed sharp pine needles all over your carpet. Yes, that Christmas tree was canceled. Sort of.
What?
Well, sort of. I now take you to 1902, Washington, D.C., the capital of these United States, and back into the White House. But we're not with the Cleveland family. At this time, the Roosevelts are residing there, as one Teddy Roosevelt is the president. Now, y'all know my adoration for Teddy. We have spoken of him on the podcast before. He has faults, naturally. However, this man's life was wild, and we may have to do an episode just on him one day.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
I mean, he is just fantastic. Anyway, there's Teddy and his wife Edith and their six children, Alice, Theodore Jr., Kermit, Ethel, Archibald, and Quentin. We're in his first term as president. And here in the U.S., if you don't know, a president can serve up to 8 years, so 2 terms of 4 years each. But we've had a rare few that only got one and then were voted out, most recently. Well, recently. And the press loved covering them. They were apparently delightful. And as alluded to, Teddy was the dream with all his past shenanigans, how active he was as a president, and a quick wit to boot. The whole package. For the purposes of this story, 2 things you need to know about Teddy. First, he was a lifelong conservationist. He loved him some environment. And part of being president means you get this nifty perk called executive orders. They aren't like king's decree, off with their heads shit. Some are utterly meaningless and just for the purpose of showing off. But some could be on par, in a way, with federal laws. For instance, stuff such as maybe declaring a state of national emergency. Can Congress overturn them? I mean, yeah, they could try to sneak around it by passing a bill that canceled out whatever it was. But then guess where bills go? To the president for he or she to sign off. They're not going to sign off. The Supreme Court can also get involved to overturn it, but it has to be something that's blatantly unconstitutional. So, for the most part, as long as it's in the realm of reasonable, the president can executive order lots of stuff. Teddy was a fan. And guess what a chunk of his executive orders focused on? Quote, Roosevelt extensively used executive orders on a number of occasions to protect forest and wildlife lands during his tenure as president. By the end of his second term in office, Roosevelt used executive orders to establish 150 million acres, or 600,000 square kilometers, of reserved forestry land. The areas of the United States that he placed under public protection totals approximately 230 million acres, or 930,000 square kilometers. In total, Roosevelt used executive orders to establish 121 forest reserves in 31 states, setting aside more federal land, national parks, and nature preserves than all of his predecessors combined.
Way to go, Teddy.
And he was the 26th president, so yeah, wow. There were also something like 51 bird reserves. He was concerned about the impact on the environment that the dependence on coal, iron, and ore was causing. And even though he was an avid hunter, he advocated against what was, as one of my sources called it, the mass slaughter of big game species like bison and elk. Second thing you need to know, Teddy also loved him some Christmas. And we know this both from his biographers and his own autobiography. His parents, Thee and Mitty, did all they could to make it special for their children. One of Teddy's biographers saying that his mother in particular, quote, gloried in piling the Christmas table high with toys for her children, and she loved to watch their glee on Christmas morning. In his autobiography, Teddy talks about, quote, nabbing big stockings from the grown-ups, hanging them up the night before Christmas, and opening them the morning of on his parents' bed. After breakfast, Thee and Mitty would throw open the doors of the drawing room where each child had his or her presents piled on their own table. If they happened to be out of town on Christmas, their father would take them along to do charitable deeds. In short, and in Teddy's own words, for him, Christmas was, quote, an occasion of literally delirious joy. And also, quote, I never knew anyone else to have what seemed to me such attractive Christmases. And in the next generation, I tried to reproduce them exactly for my own children. And further, in a letter to his sister Corinne in 1903, quote, I wonder whether there ever can come in life a thrill of greater exaltation and rapture than that which comes to one between the ages of, say, 6 and 14, when the library door is thrown open and you walk in to see all the gifts, like a materialized fairyland, arrayed on your special table. Now, you've caught that I've mentioned tables 3 times, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, tuck that away. All right. These two things he loved were at odds in one respect, though. And that was, you guessed it, the Christmas tree. Now, he and Edith still did it up for the kids. Don't misunderstand me. And you'll hear more about that in a second. But they didn't have a Christmas tree. This was their second holiday in the White House. They didn't have one the year prior, either. Several of his predecessors had all done up trees, so what's the deal? And that's when the speculation began. Teddy Roosevelt, because of his environmental activism, has banned Christmas trees.
Oh, man.
Dun, dun, dun.
It begins. He's part of they.
He's they. He's one of them. They want to cancel Christmas. But what about the children? People asked. And it was because while not all his predecessors had done up the trees, it was only the ones who had kids in the house. Quote, Roosevelt, of course, had multiple little ones living with him at the White House, which is perhaps why the family's treeless Christmas was remarked upon in contemporary newspaper reports. And this reporting had happened the last year, and it would happen this year, and it would continue for several more. So in 1901, the New York Daily Tribune simply said, quote, following an established custom in the Roosevelt household, there will be no Christmas tree this year at the White House. Seems fairly straightforward. Not gossipy. They're just not explaining anything, probably because they had no information with which to explain. But also in 1901, the Washington Times pointed out that they'd heard guests at the White House were, quote, disappointed about the lack of a tree, and, quote, they had supposed that with so many children, the tree would be indispensable. And now, in 1902, the New York Sun reiterated that, quote, while the Roosevelts would spend the morning exchanging gifts, there will be no Christmas tree at the White House because of that Rough Rider sumbitch. I'm kidding. That last part's a lie. They didn't say that. But the point is, people were fixated on this. Like, two Christmases in a row now, they're reporting on it. And it would seem that at least one member of the Roosevelt family might have been a little fixated on it, too. So here we are in December of 1902, Christmas morning, and the children have come banging on Teddy and Edith's bedroom door at half past the crack of dawn, and that's because all their stockings are hanging on the fireplace in their parents' room. So they get up, put all the stockings onto the bed, and let the heathens in. The kids dig into their stockings, and then it's time for breakfast. After that, into the library, where there are, you guessed it, tables set up, one for each of the kids, with their big presents on them. Quentin got an electric train set, Archie got some riding boots, and Teddy and Edith gave each other a bunch of books. Then at some point, 8-year-old Archie says to Teddy, hey, Pops, come look in this closet. He says, sure, son. A little weird, but all right. And there's a Christmas tree. Please don't imagine just a plain pine leaned up against the wall. No, friends. Listen to what this 8-year-old had done. He talks one of the White House stewards, which basically being a steward entails general household stuff that they're assigned to do. Could be office work, could be to do with the kitchen or dining. Anyway, Archie slips a steward a cool 20 cents and is like, go to the market, get me however much of a Christmas tree this will buy, and get it to me without being seen.
I love it. This is the best.
You might think this would be a heavy task, and maybe. But I should also let you know that the tree was approximately 2 feet tall.
Oh, it's a little baby.
Now he's got to hide it till Christmas Day, and he is an observant little shit. And he knows of a closet that his mother rarely gets into. One place I saw said it was the seamstress's closet. Whatever, doesn't matter. Archie now draws into the plan the White House carpenter to help him set it up. And I'm picturing like 2x4s crossed in the trunk, nailed to it, like make a stand for it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now for the decorations. Archie then convinces the White House electrician to help him string it with lights. Where did he get the lights? How did he plug them in? I have no idea. I suspect there's much more to this story that we'll never know. Because guess what else? He has managed to get a present for each of his 5 siblings, his mother, his father, Jack the dog, Algonquin the pony, and Tom Quartz, the new kitten. These gifts are all tied onto the branches.
This poor little tree. Oh my God.
It is Snoopy, Charlie Brown Christmas, just bending over, just struggling to stay upright. Teddy sees all this and falls to his knees, weeping. He hugs the tree, then pulls back, pine needles stuck to his tear-stained face, whispering, "Why, son? Why?" Then he whoops Archie's ass. Yeah. In front of the kitten. In front of the kitten and everything. He fired the steward, he fired the carpenter, fired the electrician, also in front of the kitten.
No.
Yeah, all in front of the kitten. No, that's not even close to what happened.
You bitch.
He was jaw-dropped, but he loved his kids' ingenuity. And while they continued to do their Christmas table thing in the years that followed, there was a change. I'll tell you about it in a second. But anyway, it seemed like every December, this would keep getting brought up. This thing about the Roosevelts not having trees. And like I say, he held 2 terms, so we're talking 8 years here. And now, of course, they had this charming little anecdote about Archie to tack on. So they, quote, not only remarked that the Roosevelts would once again not have a Christmas tree, but also speculated whether Archie would pull a fast one on his father. So, okay, it got less accusatory and more cheeky. Like, for instance, South Carolina's Greenville News in 1904 speculated on what Santa Claus's reaction would be, that he would visit the White House like he visited all the other homes, but he wouldn't be bringing them a tree. At the same time, some papers shifted gears, and they'd maybe mention it, yeah, but they didn't jump on the tree-banning train. From the aforementioned New York Sun, quote, "In the private part of the house, conditions are such that Mrs. Roosevelt finds she cannot devote a single room to a tree, and therefore it has been decided by the president and herself that the children must have their tree at the home of their uncle and aunt." A big tree, that is, because Archie's not done, and neither am I. In any event, I personally think, and in my sources, several historians think this as well, I think that it just wasn't in their family traditions, because as we've covered, Christmas trees were just around this ballpark getting more commonplace, and this is a classic case of one generation, the kids, finding meaning in something that the older generation, the parents, don't get. But to other adults, mom and dad, apparently, like these tables. The tables, I don't know why that just kills me. Where do you get all the tables? Like, I guess you're pulling in tables from other rooms? Like, how do you give each child a table? Okay, Christmas tables. Maybe that's the title of the episode. Fancy Nuts and Christmas Tables. Anyway, as far as that whole conservation part, did Teddy really believe this? Did he think Christmas trees were harmful? Or did he maybe think, this is a tiny tree, let the kids have their fun? Well, as writer Robert Lincoln O'Brien, who'd served as White House executive clerk, noted in Ladies' Home Journal in 1903, quote, "The main motive of Mr. and Mrs. Roosevelt is to enjoy Christmas as simply as possible." And he addressed this rumor directly, saying, quote, "The president's love for the living things of the forest in their own natural setting is so great, it has been suggested, that he prefers not to encourage the wanton slaughter of small trees." And then O'Brien points out, if this were true, Teddy, quote, "has not so informed his closest friends." Not friends, nor colleagues, it would seem, because he collaborated closely with the head of the U.S. Forest Service during his presidency, a man named Gifford Pinchot. And Pinchot was on the record saying, with relation to cutting down trees for Christmas seasonally, he didn't believe that forests would be harmed. Did any of this matter? No, it did not. According to one of my sources, it was basically being reported as fact starting around 1909, but there's simply no evidence for it. And I was shocked to see that WhiteHouseHistory.org, which features this great sketch of the family at the moment the closet tree is revealed, perpetuates this story, and they've also got the wrong year listed. Much disappoint. Back to that Christmas, though. Like I say, Teddy didn't mind. He actually wrote to President Andrew Garfield about it at one point and just described it as a surprise. Archie started a new Roosevelt family tradition. In the years that followed, he and baby brother Quentin had a small Christmas tree in their bedroom. Teddy writing in a letter in December of 1906 that the boys, quote, "have gradually worked up a variant on what is otherwise a strictly inherited form of our celebration, for they fix up, or at least Archie fixes up, a special Christmas tree in his room." Then, check this out. While Teddy and Edith were, quote, "busy admiring Archie's tree, two of the children had slipped out, and when we got back to our own room, there was a small lighted Christmas tree with 2 huge stockings for Edith and myself. It was an ideal Christmas."
These kids are resourceful.
And they love their parents, clearly. I mean, that is so sweet. That just, it makes me grin hearing that.
Mm-hmm.
But do you need more proof that Teddy Roosevelt did not hate Christmas trees? I got you, boo. Following his presidency, the Roosevelts ultimately settled in Oyster Bay, New York. And there is a delightful article in a December 1920 edition of the New York Tribune about our Betty Teddy. The Roosevelts provided a Christmas tree, which Mr. Roosevelt cut down himself in the woods of Sagamore Hill with the help of an employee. I mean, of course he did.
Yeah.
Nothing about that sentence surprises me in the least. Anyway, so he cuts it down, provided a Christmas tree to Cove Neck Elementary School, where it was decorated by a teacher. Then Mr. Roosevelt acted as Santa Claus. When the tree was unveiled, he was on hand early, his arms full with a store of mysterious packages and bundles, and his eyes critically appraising the last-minute decorations. The colonel, beaming from ear to ear, announced that he had been delegated by Saint Nick to act as his emissary, and began reading from the packages which crowded the foot of the tree the names of the various fortunate recipients. So no, Teddy Roosevelt did not ban Christmas trees, neither for his family nor for the country. He and the missus thought that they took up too much room. They're kind of messy. They like their tables, but let the kids have a small one in their own room if they so desired. And to wrap up, we say all this to say, when in modern day people spout off about Christmas being canceled or certain traditions being traditional all the way back to time immemorial, they have no idea what they speak. As we've told you, there were times when Christmas celebrations were literally not allowed, at least publicly, public with a K. So asking people to be kind and think of others who don't celebrate Christmas by saying happy holidays takes nothing away from their own celebration and is not canceling their celebration. Just like asking people not to gather in groups around Christmas time this year, like by going shopping in malls, going to Christmas parades, or gathering on Christmas Day itself with non-household family members during a deadly pandemic is also not canceling Christmas. It's just asking that people celebrate it in a different way, like over the phone or video chats, just this once, to prevent the spread of disease so that we can go back to having our normal holiday gatherings next year.
Yeah.
You know, let's have another chat over here on the sofa. Let's even turn on some mood music. Make this really meaningful. Let's have a real moment, you and me. Think about it this way. The holiday is supposed to be about joy and wishes and giving to others, right? And I can't think of a greater joy than not just wishing good health, but by giving good health, both to those we love and to our communities in general. As y'all know, I'm a clinician, not gonna tell you more, secret identity and all, but there's a good chunk of letters after my name and lots of student loan debt. So trust me when I say, doctors and nurses are tired, y'all. Very, very, very tired. So do us a solid. Even if you feel great, assume you're carrying the virus. Assume you can infect others. And assume if you don't act accordingly, I'll be actively wishing Krampus comes to visit you instead of Santa. And so we leave you with these final thoughts from Dr. Seuss via the Grinch, when he has awoken Christmas morning under the impression that he has canceled Christmas for the town of Whoville.
And he did hear a sound rising over the snow. It started in low, then it started to grow. But this sound wasn't sad. Why, this sound sounded glad. He hadn't stopped Christmas from coming. It came. Somehow or other, it came, just the same. Welcome, Christmas. Bring your cheer. Cheer to all who's far and near. Christmas Day will always be, just as long as we have we.
So Merry Christmas to all our little Whos. We hope you have a happy and safe holiday. And you will have a spooky snack coming at you at some point. Our schedule's all off kilter because you got a regular episode, then you're getting this one early, like way early. A full episode will have come out, then you're going to get this on Christmas Eve, which is the Thursday following the Sunday that episode will have come out. So we're going to be a little wonky with the schedule. And Tiff and I are going to pretty much take off the rest of the year. So we went ahead and recorded a spooky snack for you. So you're going to get that because it's about a recent current event. And I think you're going to find it really interesting. We laughed a lot. It was a good one.
It is a good one.
So you'll have that. And you can find out how to reach us by listening to the outro that's about to come up in mere moments. It'll tell you how to get hold of us on social media, the blog, email, all that jazz.
Happy holidays.
Ho, ho, ho.
this is where the catchphrase goes.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for listening. As a reminder, you can check out our sources for each of the episodes at show notes, along with any supplemental things we think you might enjoy.
Visit us on our blog at youtotallymadethatup.tumblr.com. You can also find us on Twitter at YTMTUpodcast and on Instagram at youtotallymadethatup. Feel free to contact us on those platforms, and you can also email us. That address is youtotallymadethatup@gmail.com.